the agency's detention interrogation program, I believe, was instrumental in keeping this country safe in the aftermath of 9/11. Were mistakes made in it? Absolutely. But the agency was directed and authorized to carry out this program to the best of its capabilities, even though it had never done it before. At the same time, though, I believe that those EITs are not necessary. And I know that there has been calls for, you know, waterboarding or worse, whatever else. As long as I'm director of CIA, we're not going to go down that road again. The Army's field manual is the basis for the debriefing and interrogations that take place. We provide support to other elements of the government, whether it be domestic or the ones that are operating overseas. But I do not believe that it is necessary to use those EITs, nor do I believe it is advisable from the standpoint of the agency's future, as well as this country's reputation and standing in the world.
I'm Quinta Jurecic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 6th, 2016. That was Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, John Brennan. Director Brennan came to the Brookings Institution on July 13th for a conversation with Brookings Senior Fellow Bruce Riedel on the CIA's strategy in the face of emerging challenges. Following an introduction by General John Allen, the two discussed a range of topics, from the Arab Spring to the drone program, to the importance of integration across intelligence agencies. And yes, they also mentioned Donald Trump. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 182, John Brennan on Emerging Challenges.
Thank you all who are here today very much for being here. And it certainly is a pleasure to be back at Brookings and to be among some very good friends and colleagues that I see here in the audience. And I must say that Bruce Riedel and I have known each other for over 35 years. We look much different 35 years ago, I can assure you. But I very much look forward to my conversation with Bruce this afternoon and to addressing your questions. But first, though, I would like to start off with some brief remarks. I have spoken recently in public settings about the many overseas threats that we face as a nation and the importance and challenges associated with dealing with countries like Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. And I'll be happy to address your questions about such issues when we get to the Q&A session. But for now, I'd like to focus my remarks on how CIA is working to meet these challenges, specifically the challenges of ungoverned spaces and of the digital revolution. Two defining features of global instability that keep us quite busy at Langley and around the globe. Clearly, the world in 2016 is witnessing a significant amount of instability and has been for some time. Now, instability is a rather vague and antiseptic term, but we all know that it carries some very real costs, especially in terms of humanitarian suffering, rising extremist violence, and diminishing freedom throughout the community of nations. In fact, Freedom House this year reported an acceleration in a decade-long slide in democracy around the world. The number of countries showing a decline in freedom for the year, 72, was the largest since the downward trend began. The challenges we face today are unprecedented in both their variety and their complexity. They are highly fluid, constantly shifting, and taking on new dimensions. And they are increasingly interconnected, testing our ability to anticipate how developments in one realm will shape events in another. When CIA analysts consider the trends that are shaping the world's events in the coming decade, they look at dynamics such as rapid population growth and urbanization in the developing world. They look at technological advances that vastly outpace the ability of governments to manage them, as well as at slow economic growth globally. Now, if these trends hold, we could see greater volatility and increased demands on nation states, which are already under the greatest stress we have seen in many years, perhaps going back to the period following the First World War. Governments worldwide have found that handling the daunting array of 21st century challenges on their own, those related to economics, security, technology, demographics, climate change, and so on, is increasingly difficult, if not impossible, to handle on their own. The United States and other nations are lending assistance to many of these countries so that they can better deal with these pressures and maintain cohesion. And just as the various departments of our government provide aid and expertise to their counterparts in weakened states, the agency plays a role as well. In many cases, CIA helps to enhance the capability of foreign security and intelligence services so that they can increase the quality and quantity of intelligence they provide to us to help address threats of mutual interest, such as violent extremism, within and from across their borders. But our assistance and partnership come with conditions. These intelligence and security services must adhere to standards of professional conduct and respect for human rights in order to maintain that partnership with us. And nowhere do we find greater challenges to effective governance than in the region that stretches from the Maghreb to South Asia. Faced with rapidly growing and youthful populations, North Africa and the Middle East have some of the world's highest unemployment among 12 to 24-year-olds. These trends foster the appeal of militant ideas in states that are already struggling to govern territory and meet the very basic needs of their people. Not surprisingly, this is the region where we have seen a dangerous rise in ungoverned spaces, the kind of places where the self-proclaimed Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant was able to establish its reign of terror. And these are precisely the kinds of places in which CIA must operate. To provide the president and his senior advisors with the insights that they need, the agency collects critical intelligence wherever there is a need. And when we must acquire ground truth in austere and difficult locations, where there is no official U.S. government presence or established liaison partner, the conventional approach of operating out of a station is not an option. Given this imperative, one of the things that we are looking at is how we can enhance further our expeditionary capabilities, which depend on the ability to operate with agility and a light footprint. And because of many of our greatest national security challenges, they have emerged in these ungoverned spaces and are likely to do so in the coming years, CIA must be expeditionary in both spirit and in action. This is a tradition that stretches back to the Second World War, when the agency's predecessors in the Office of Strategic Services parachuted behind enemy lines in occupied Europe. And only 15 days after the September 11th attacks, teams of CIA officers were the first Americans on Afghan soil, leading our nation's response by taking the fight to Al-Qaeda. And whether in expeditionary missions or in our day-to-day operations, we have seen since 9/11 that the power of integration is the single most decisive factor in optimizing our intelligence capabilities across the board. To that end, the agency last year launched a modernization program, which is a strategic effort to better integrate and leverage CIA's unique as well as its many strengths. The centerpiece of our modernization initiative was the creation of 10 mission centers, the line organizations that now bring together our operational, analytical, technical, digital, and support disciplines. 6 of these centers focus on regions of the world, such as Africa and the Near East, and 4 focus on functional issues, such as counterterrorism and counterproliferation. We needed to create an architecture that would best position the agency to respond quickly and effectively to current and future challenges, much like the Department of Defense did in the aftermath of the Goldwater-Nichols Act. Today, our analysts, our case officers, and our technical and digital and support officers work together within these centers in much the same way they have learned to collaborate in stations around the world. And that means we can come up to speed far more quickly on any breaking issue that might emerge somewhere on the globe. Beyond the challenge of ungoverned spaces, the digital revolution is perhaps the defining feature of our unstable world in both the most positive and negative ways. The cyber realm and information technology have fundamentally transformed the most prevalent means of human interaction. These technologies have given rise to new information-based industries that have displaced older ones, sometimes deepening gaps within societies and between the developed and underdeveloped worlds. They enable social interaction that can be swift and destabilizing, as we saw in the so-called Arab Spring. And they invest individuals with unprecedented influence and even power, for better and for worse. Cyber makes it possible for our adversaries to sabotage vital infrastructure without ever landing an agent on our shores. And we have seen how our own citizens can be indoctrinated by terrorist groups online to commit terrible acts of violence here in our homeland. Moreover, these technologies are transforming how an intelligence service, which is a quintessential information-based enterprise, how it conducts its business. And we at CIA fully understand that how we rise to the challenge of the digital age will determine the extent of our future success. That's why last year, as part of our modernization program, we created a Directorate of Digital Innovation, the first new agency directorate in more than a half century. This new directorate is at the center of the agency's effort to hasten the adoption of digital solutions into every aspect of our work. It is accelerating the integration of our digital and cyber capabilities across all of our mission areas: espionage, all-source analysis, open-source intelligence, liaison engagement, covert action, counterintelligence. The directorate is deeply involved in our efforts to defend against foreign cyber attacks. It has an important role to play in human intelligence collection by helping safeguard the cover of our clandestine operatives in the information age. Equally important, the directorate oversees our open source enterprise, a unit dedicated to collecting, analyzing, and disseminating publicly available information of value to national security. Multiple elements of the agency in the past have responded to the challenges of the digital era. But if we are to excel in the wired world, the digital domain must be part of every aspect of our mission. In practical terms, it means that our operations officers must be able to maintain their cover in a dynamic digital environment and collect in it as well. It means that our analysts must be able to quickly process and analyze enormous volumes of data. And it means that our IT experts must be able to harden our networks against intrusion and better protect are very important and sensitive sources and methods. We at CIA and our colleagues throughout government are doing what we can to meet the challenges of the digital revolution. But even whole-of-government solutions are simply not enough when it comes to cyber. That's because some 85% of the Internet is owned and operated by the private sector, which is why we need to have an honest, vigorous dialogue between public and private sector stakeholders about government's proper role in the cyber domain. In that vein, we need to have a more robust and comprehensive national discourse about how the government and the private sector must work together to safeguard the security, the reliability, the resilience, and the prosperity of the digital domain. Such public-private dialogue and partnerships will be increasingly important as technologies advance and new fields of endeavor emerge as we move further into the 21st century. It is truly a tremendous honor for me every day to carry the title of Director of the Central Intelligence Agency. It is my privilege and pleasure to work with some of the most dedicated American patriots that we have, who every day put themselves forward, sometimes at great risk to themselves, in order to protect their fellow citizens. It is an agency that I am exceptionally proud of, and as long as I'm Director of Central Intelligence Agency, I will work with my colleagues to do everything possible to make sure that the CIA is able to play an essential role in securing the future of this great country. Thank you so much. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much. I also want to add to General Allen's thanks to you, John, for coming here today, for spending time with us. I think it's vital in our country, especially in an election year, that we hear from people like you explaining what the issues are and how our country is dealing with them. And I do want to say one other thing. Yes, John and I have known each other for more than 35 years. 35 years ago, we both had hair. Other than that, I don't think a lot has changed, and certainly in the Middle East and South Asia. And I want to go right to that. You talked about stepping backwards in terms of the Freedom Index and how we have fewer free countries today than we did just 4 or 5 years ago. Well, of course, the biggest failure of the Freedom Index in the last 5 years has been the catastrophic outcome of the Arab Spring. When the Arab Spring began, I argued, and many others did, that it was an existential threat to Al-Qaeda and Islamic jihadism, that this was a revolution that showed there was an alternative to jihad. 5 years later, it's pretty hard to make that case anymore. As we think about the business of countering the Islamic narrative, the Islamic ideology, how do we get around that central problem today?
Well, you're absolutely right. The Arab Spring was viewed, I think, with great hope in many parts of the world, including especially by those in the Middle East who were suffering in many instances under great repression. And I think there was obviously a very strong and widespread populist movement that they knew what they were opposed to in terms of corruption, graft, the fact that the authoritarian regimes were not able to take care of the basic needs of the people. And the tinder was very dry throughout the Middle East, and that's why when the Tunisian fruit salesman self-immolated, it was the spark that set off the entire region. So there was great, I think, consensus about what they were opposed to. But given the lack of political institutions and any type of political freedoms that existed there, there were not the institutions that enabled the new wave of individuals who were aspiring to change the system for the better to capitalize on. And so Al-Qaeda, ISIL, none of them were responsible for the Arab Spring, but they took great advantage of the aftermath of the Arab Spring and the inability of the new governments that emerged to be able to adapt to what the new reality was, which was great pressure from the streets. But the lack of those political institutions, those democratic institutions that I think a lot of people aspired to, just allowed continued chaos in some areas, as well as just a failure of the subsequent governments to be able to address the needs. And I must say, when I look at the problems in the Middle East and South Asia, the economic, political, social, sectarian challenges are formidable. So it's not as though anybody, had a light switch that they could just flip.
Right.
This is a process, it's a journey. I think sometimes the expectations, including here in Washington, that democracy was all of a sudden going to break out and flourish once the authoritarian leaders were toppled, they were way out of sync with what the reality of the Middle East is.
Let me focus in on one partner that you know very well in particular. In a recent interview with Al Arabiya, you said that the CIA has an excellent cooperation with Saudi Arabia, and we have really strong partners in King Salman, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, and Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And I agree with that. I think there's no doubt that Saudi Arabia has helped foil more than one attack on the United States, and you probably know more than dozens on the United States. At the same time, many Americans and many Muslims would argue that the kind of Islam that is propagated in Saudi Arabia, what we call Wahhabism, is the very sea in which Al-Qaeda and Islamic Jihad ideology is born. So on the one hand, there's no doubt in the strict counterterrorism arena, the Saudis are a crucial, important ally. But in the kind of ideological narrative and in the whole business of what is Islam about, many would argue they are the problem. As the director of Central Intelligence, your main focus is on problem one, not on fixing Saudi Arabia. But do you see this contradiction, and how would you think about explaining to Americans how we square this circle?
Well, I will emphasize just the importance of the security and intelligence relationship that we have with Saudi Arabia. They went through their own 9/11 2003, 2004,
right,
while Al-Qaeda killed a lot of Saudis, including their security and intelligence professionals. And so Saudi Arabia is among our closest counterterrorism partners. The Mabahith and the GIP, the General Intelligence Presidency, are really very close partners with us. But you're right that the Saudi government and leadership today has inherited a history whereby there have been a number of individuals, both inside of Saudi Arabia as well as outside, who have embraced a rather fundamentalist, extremist in some areas, version of the Islamic faith, which has allowed individuals who then move toward violence and terrorism to exploit that and capitalize on it. As you well know, with the Iranian Revolution in 79, 80, the Iranians then were pushing out a lot of their propagation and proselytization as they were funding a number of elements abroad through Africa and other areas. And the Saudi government was trying to counter that in this Sunni-Shia sort of competition in many of these areas. And unfortunately, I think a lot of these very fundamentalist realms of Saudi-supported organizations were fully exploited by individuals who wanted to use that as a springboard for militancy, extremism, and terrorism. And when I've talked to my Saudi partners, they recognize that they have an issue and a problem that they have to deal with. Again, it's getting back to that there is no light switch that can transition a country like Saudi Arabia that just a generation or so ago was really anchored in a very traditional environment. There has been explosive growth in Saudi Arabia in terms of they have all the trappings of modernization, but yet the environment, the culture, the society, and the religious traditions really have not yet adapted to 21st century world, right, which is one of the things that the Saudis are having to deal with.
You mentioned they had their own Al-Qaeda moment a decade ago. It looks like they may be on the verge of another Al-Qaeda moment. We just had, on the 4th of July, bombings in three Saudi cities simultaneously. Now, thanks to the good work of the Saudi security services, the number of casualties were relatively small. One attack in particular, the attack on the Prophet's Mosque in Medina, stands out as unprecedented. Al-Qaeda, at its worst, never attacked the two holy mosques. No one has claimed credit for that attack so far. Do you think you know who's responsible for it? And are you worried about the trajectory of terrorism inside the kingdom today?
I think those attacks bear the hallmarks of ISIL, Daesh, as the Saudis and the Arabs call them. Although Al-Qaeda still presents a threat, whether it be Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is really anchored in Yemen, there's Al-Qaeda inside of Syria and other areas, ISIL presents a very, very serious threat, not just to Europe and here in the United States with all of their efforts to reach out, but inside of Saudi Arabia. And so those three attacks were, I think, the work of ISIL. You're right, the attack in Medina is troubling. It was directed against Saudi security forces that were there, and several security members were killed. But one of the things that Saudi Arabia has to do is to make sure that the two holy places in Islam, Medina and Mecca, are going to be open and available to Muslims worldwide. And the Saudis have to deal every year with the major Hajj, as well as just throughout the year in terms of Umrah and other visitors that come to the kingdom. So they have a tremendous amount of security that's been dedicated to it. But there is no security that is 100% risk-free. And so that's why Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, who also is the Minister of Interior, who has been a very close partner of ours, really has focused on trying to maintain internal security and to counter this growth of ISIL's presence inside of Saudi Arabia and along its borders.
Let me turn for a minute to some of the tactics that we've used in counterterrorism, particularly in the Obama administration. Let me start with one they haven't used. 7.5 years ago, President Obama came into office and I think very wisely decided that so-called enhanced interrogation tactics would no longer be used, no longer waterboarding. There are voices now in America that are crying out to go back to that. Would we be safer using these techniques? What's your view on that judgment call?
Well, there are a couple of aspects to this. One is that, as you own the agency's detention interrogation program, I believe, was instrumental in keeping this country safe in the aftermath of 9/11. Were mistakes made in it? Absolutely. But the agency was directed and authorized to carry out this program to the best of its capabilities, even though it had never done it before.
Right.
My view is that, despite others who may argue differently, you cannot establish cause and effect between the application of these EITs and any reliable information, credible information that came out from these individuals. There were individuals who were subjected to these EITs that, subsequent to that, they provided information that was, in fact, credible and worthwhile for pursuit. But the agency suffered at great cost,
right,
because of that program. So just from an institutional perspective, I tend to be protective of the agency as a whole and the men and women of the agency to make sure that we're able to preserve and enhance the agency's ability to carry out all of our responsibilities. At the same time, though, I believe that those EITs are not necessary. And I know that there has been calls for, you know, waterboarding or worse, whatever else. As long as I'm director of CIA, we're not going to go down that road again. The Army's field manual is the basis for the debriefing and interrogations that take place. We provide support to other elements of the government, whether it be domestic or the ones that are operating overseas. But I do not believe that it is necessary to use those EITs, nor do I believe it is advisable from the standpoint of the agency's future as well as this country's reputation and standing in the world.
You said something very important in your opening remarks that reflect on this. You said that in our partnerships with foreign liaison services, we try to hold them to the same standards we have. I don't have to imagine. From my own experience, I realize that's a daunting task, to put it mildly. Could you expand a little bit on that? Because I don't think most Americans realize that the CIA is not just working with intelligence liaison partners and giving them a free pass on how they deal with the individuals who may be terrorists, may be democracy workers at the same time.
Well, I think it should be understood that the agency, in the course of its duties, will have the opportunity, indeed the imperative, to work with other organizations or individuals who may not adhere to the same standards that we do. However, we have some minimally acceptable standards that we insist that other governments, intelligence security services adhere to, as well as individuals who we might work with individually. So it's not as though they can just do what they want and continue to work with us. I have spoken to presidents abroad, as well as heads of services, about some of the abuses of human rights that have been perpetrated by their officers. And I have told them, we're going to cut off relations with your service unless there are changes or unless a certain person is removed from a chain of command. And sometimes there's hesitance, and we make good on that threat. Mm-hmm. Or they, in most instances, they oblige our request or our demands. It is critically important that the professionalism of these services is maintained. And so when we get reports of human rights abuses, extrajudicial killings, we thoroughly investigate it, and we want to make sure that we're not going to be working with those individuals and services who have stooped to the level of the terrorists that they are seeking to thwart.
I'm sure every journalist in this room is now dying for me to ask, can you be specific and tell us what country? But I'm not going to go there. I have a different question about a different tactic, and that's so-called
drones. I knew 35 years of friendship would do something.
The so-called drones. This administration inherited a drone program, but it then stepped up activities quite remarkably. Most recently, the administration, I think at the DNI's office, has put out a report on how many drone operations there have been. I think the number of drone operations was 473, not counting in combat zones, and that the number of terrorists killed in those operations was somewhere around 2,500. But it also said that somewhere between, I think, 64 and 116 civilians have died in that operations as well. 7.5 years after this administration started using drones, how would you characterize their importance in the struggle against Al-Qaeda and now Islamic State? Have they been, as I think many people would look at this administration and say, this is the central weapon in the battle against these groups? Of course, others are calling it a very controversial position. I'd like to hear your balance sheet on how vital this has been to the United States.
And those statistics that were recently put out, they refer to counterterrorism operations carried out by the United States outside of areas of active hostilities. And they include not just drone, it could be fixed-wing aircraft or something else. So that's the aggregation of all of those operations. And the drones, the predators, reapers, are tremendously capable, capable platforms that provide a variety of capabilities to the U.S. government as they are operated overseas. Tremendous ISR, which is intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, because they have the ability to watch areas with full motion video, as well as to have technical collection capability that they can be in an area that may be denied to us otherwise. They are not manned, although they are piloted remotely. Right. And they have what's called persistent dwell, which allows there to be the acquisition of that intelligence, either visual or technical, for a sustained period of time, which allows you to have much greater fidelity about what it is that's happening on the ground. Those platforms give you the opportunity to use the intelligence that it acquires and correlate it with other intelligence that you may have, whether it's human intelligence on the ground or other technical capabilities. And so it is that interaction between those intelligence feeds that's very, very powerful. And then also, these platforms have the ability to deliver ordnance onto a target. And the fact that they can watch in a persistent fashion on a target, they have the ability then to observe exactly who is there and make some determinations and decisions about who it is. And that's why the president has come out and has said that we need near certainty of the target, who it is, as well as near certainty that there'll be no collateral. Now, none of this is risk-free, but these platforms have been able to use that that great intelligence capability, marry it then with the kinetic capability, so it's called find, fix, and finish, that the U.S. government, and these are platforms that have been integrated into the U.S. military for quite some time. And it has such precision, and they have laser-guided weapons that allow those remote pilots to be able to target the individual or the location with tremendous precision, as well as be able to observe whether or not the situation on the ground has changed from the point of a trigger to the point of impact. And if the situation has changed, and if there are civilians who happen to wander into that field of fire, the remote pilots have the ability to redirect, to shift cold that ordnance. And so they can continue to watch over the target while that strike takes place, as well as to look at it afterward and continue to observe it from the standpoint of what the battle damage assessment is going to be. So it's a tremendously capable instrument for intelligence collection, as well as an instrument of war that not just the United States, but other countries now are using. It helps to protect pilots. They're not flying in these areas. It has limitations, but as the technological advances are incorporated into one's military, the drones, the predators, are key to making sure that we are able to carry out these operations when necessary, but with the greatest accuracy and precision.
Many of the critics argue that this is operating in a realm where there is no international legal authority. And to a certain extent, by definition, when you operate in another country's airspace without their approval, you're in that territory. You mentioned that other countries are going to be in the drone business, too. And I don't think it's hard to imagine a Russia using drones in the Ukraine someday, or China using drones in Tibet or someplace like that. Seems to me these are kind of irreconcilable. I find it very hard to imagine a Geneva-style treaty in which countries all come down and say, here's the rules by which drones will operate, which puts even more burden on our government in how it handles going forward on this. I'm struck at how much President Obama seems to see that burden as his burden and to get that done in his 8 years in office. He's been criticized for releasing these documents on the eve of the 4th of July. I understand why you do that. Do you think there's going to be more coming from the White House on the parameters and rules of engagement, say?
Well, I give President Obama a lot of credit for what we have accomplished on the counterterrorism front, but also for his willingness and keen interest in trying to be as open as possible, not just with the American people, but with the world, about the counterterrorism operations this country has engaged in. And I think what he has done is to take full ownership of the activities that took place under his leadership. He also, I think, is trying to say, we have an established process here that we try to be as good as we can be in terms of following our process procedures, and we're going to be open with what it is that the results of this these operations have been. And I would make a point. You said in your question, when we operate in countries or country skies without their approval, I would challenge that. Yes, these platforms, just like a manned aircraft, could operate in countries with airspace without their approval. But the president has made very clear that what we need to do is to work with the countries where these terrorists reside and to gain their support, assistance, and approval in the conduct of these operations. A lot of times these countries don't have the capability, and they seek the support of the U.S. government and our tremendous counterterrorism capabilities. Sometimes these governments do not want to trumpet that cooperation, and they try to keep it quiet. But I will just caution people to think that the United States goes into airspace abroad without engaging with foreign governments.
I'm going to come to the audience in just a few minutes, so start thinking about your questions and give me a high sign if you have one. One more question on drones. This May, in Baluchistan in Pakistan, the United States carried out I think it's a drone operation, which killed the head of the Afghan Taliban, Mullah Mansour. It was a remarkable operation in several respects. It was the first time that the senior leadership of the Afghan Taliban had been targeted. It was the first time there had been an operation in Baluchistan. But I think most interestingly, the United States took credit publicly for this right away, and the United States military, rather than the intelligence community, was in the lead on this operation. Is that the future of where most drone operations are going to be, in that kind of more military rather than CIA role? Are we going to see more operations in which the U.S. government stands up almost immediately and says, yes, we're responsible for this? Or are we still in the, we're not quite ready to make that transition yet?
The president announced last week about the decision to maintain 8,400 troops in Afghanistan because of the continued need for us to be able to support the Afghan government. And we have not just 8,400 U.S. military, but a lot of U.S. personnel who are working in Kabul in support of the Afghan people. And the Taliban, and particularly its subgroup, the Haqqanis, have been determined and continue to attempt to carry out attacks, and sometimes are successful, against U.S. personnel inside of Afghanistan. The president has emphasized many times that he's going to do what is necessary in order to protect the security of the American people, both here and abroad. And so the decision that was made to move against the head of the Taliban, Mullah Mansour, was one that was a very deliberate decision. Mm-hmm. And I think all of these instances and maybe future opportunities will have to be looked at in the context of what the circumstances are, what the cost benefits are, and what are the alternatives to taking some of these actions. The president has always said that if we have the opportunity to stop these attacks, stop these threats, we should, short of some type of kinetic strike, we should do that. And more times than a lot of people give us credit for, individuals are captured, arrested, detained, rather than killed.
The wave of terrorism that we've seen, either directed by the Islamic State or inspired by the Islamic State, has been bad on both sides of the Atlantic, but it was particularly bad in Western Europe in the last year, in Paris and in Brussels. You talked about, I think the phrase you used was the power of integration. In the wake of those attacks, many people argue that the European governments have done a rather poor job of integrating not only between themselves, but even inside countries. I've noticed that France, for example, is now wanting to create a NC, or some people are calling about creating an NCTC in France. Do you see much progress in tangible terms of European governments now realizing that integration is so critical? And then, of course, the question that comes up most recently, the British decision to leave the European Union. The European Union doesn't have an intelligence service, but it does serve as a meeting ground for governments. Is that a step backwards on this process, or should we be worried that it's a step backwards on this process?
Well, I think the Europeans have made progress, including since the horrific attacks in Paris and Belgium. But clearly, more progress has to be made. We learned after 9/11 some very, very painful lessons about how the different parts of the U.S. government, whether it be CIA, FBI, NSA, and others, needed to work better together, not just from the standpoint of their business practices, but also knitting together networks and databases and other things. And that was difficult and painful, but we were one country, and we had one leadership, and so we were directed to do that. When you look at Europe and you look at the European Union, there are currently 28 members, soon to be, I guess, 27, that have separate legal systems, separate information technology systems, different practices as far as how they follow through on their privacy and civil liberty obligations. And so they are trying to design an architecture that will allow the timely sharing of information. But it does involve some legal, policy, information technology, and other types of adjustments. We, in the U.S. government, we have engaged intensively with our European partners just over the past 6 months. Been out to Europe. We've sat down and talked with them, share some of our experiences with them. I think they're going to continue to make some progress. But as you point out, some of the countries themselves, their internal and external services, will not talk with one another. They're not knitted together. So there is still a fair amount of work that needs to be done. But I do think it's going in the right direction, but it needs to accelerate.
All right. Let's open it up to questions. Please identify yourself when I call on you. Over here, sir.
Hi, Director Brennan. Sean Lingus with FCW Magazine. I'm wondering, in your recent reorganization, DDI, what effort you made, if any, to sync some of the cyber operations that you do at CIA with your brothers at NSA at Fort Meade. Some people have said we're in sort of a pre-9/11 moment in terms of cyber, and that coordination between the intelligence agencies could greatly improve on that. I'm wondering how much the reorganization was focused on getting you guys on the same page.
We have had extensive interaction with our colleagues throughout the intelligence community, law enforcement community, whether it be FBI, NSA, and others, in the cyber realm for many, many years. And this new directorate really encompasses many different things. There's the cybersecurity. There is how are we going to use this digital environment in order to advance our mission. A lot of people think that we were trying to replicate what NSA does. NSA's main purpose is SIGINT, signals intelligence, which is the intercept of data in motion. And so we do a lot of partnering with NSA, and we have benchmarked against them and FBI and others. And there are a fair amount of groups that are multi-agency in terms of their efforts. So as we grow, we need to take a fresh look at how the government, cyber and digital-related entities, are interoperating with one another. When I came back to the agency about 3.5 years ago, one of the first things on my plate was to take a look at how the agency handles cyber and digital issues. because I thought we were a bit scattered inside the agency. And I knew that if we weren't more coherent and better organized internally, we weren't going to be able to interoperate then with our partners effectively and efficiently. So we are going down this road. It is the digital domain is the new frontier. And that's why I emphasize the importance of having this national consensus, because there's still not agreement about on what the government's role should be in this digital domain. For years, we agreed on what the government's role should be in the physical domain, maritime, aviation. But that digital domain is still taking shape, and there are wide, wide differences of view about the government's role there. And I want to make sure that CIA is at least configured appropriately in order to be part of the ecosystem of the public and private sector so that we can ensure this nation's security.
Right over here.
Thank you. Ron Sanders with Booz Allen and kind of a former. Director Brennan, I have a mundane organizational question. You talked about restructuring the agency into its 10 centers, and in passing you referenced Goldwater Nichols, and we know that it took our military at least a decade, maybe longer, to fully embrace this culture of jointness. So can you talk a little bit about what you're doing behind the scenes in the agency to make sure this isn't just rearranging the deck chairs, that you really are reinventing the culture at CIA to something that's collaborative and more integrative?
Well, you can talk a lot about integrating across the various mission areas and encourage that type of integration. My view was, unless you really take some tangible steps to change organizational structures, processes, practices, you're still going to have a lot of those cultures that are opposed to that remain. And so we, myself and senior leadership team, we regularly engage with our workforce. This week I had several meetings with several hundred agency officers to make sure they understand the motivation, the vision behind the modernization effort, which is to take full advantage of the tremendous expertise and capabilities and tools and authorities that the agency has, and to make sure that we're able to mutually empower one another. And so the new officers who are coming into the agency, and particularly over the last year and a half, those who were unfamiliar with working in that previous environment, they've embraced it. They say it makes, you know, a hell of a lot of sense. But so many of these things are related. So you have human resource structures and practices that are inconsistent with what it is that we're trying to do now, so we're trying to adapt it. This is a continuous process of improvement. People ask me when the modernization effort is going to be over. I said, it's never going to be over. The environment within which we operate globally is constantly changing. The successful organizations are the ones that are going to be able to adapt quickly, effectively, efficiently to that changing environment. And technology has really just fundamentally and profoundly changed the intelligence profession. It's much different than when I started in 1980. You know, I had an electric typewriter. That was the, you know, most technologically advanced piece of, you know, of equipment that I had. Now things are changing so rapidly.
Actually shared an electric typewriter with another officer, so that was Antoine.
Antoine von Hockmaus, thank you very much. I'm a Brookings trustee. I had a question. There's a lot of talk, and you spoke about the sharing of information and brain power, which is obviously necessary. But do you worry sometimes about a shadow side to this, which is that it could open up greater vulnerability to cyber attacks and also to bad apples?
Well, absolutely. When I think about the Internet of Things, to give an example, sort of a corollary in the private sector or the globally, everything at some point is going to be interconnected. It increasingly is so. And it creates tremendous facilitation of what it is that we want to do. But also there seems to be an inherent vulnerability, because if it's interconnected, then there are some ways, theoretically, that you're going to be able to navigate into something for destructive purposes. So as we put together our information technology architecture, we need to make sure that we are trying to optimize sort of both objectives. One objective is to make sure that people who need access to information within the agency and within the government have access to it, because intelligence is not an end in itself. It is used to empower something else. So we need to configure it so that there is that optimal ability of information to be accessible to the people who have that responsibility to leverage it. At the same time, you want to configure it in a way, both from a technical standpoint as well as from a insider threat perspective, that will make it as difficult as possible for there to be some type of unauthorized disclosure or hemorrhaging of the information beyond the realm that you're trying to feed. So one can't go forward without having a tandem effort to make sure that as we advance information sharing, we're not disadvantaging our security. That's the challenge. But I do think that we can optimize both in a manner that's going to give us the access we need while at the same time the security that certainly I and others demand.
Right there with the papers in the hand.
Thank you very much, Mr. Director. I'm Elliot Hurwitz. I was a former Defense Intelligence Agency contractor, and I taught at the Defense Intelligence College. Sir, you spoke about the airspace and the president's commitment not to invade foreign countries' airspace. About 5 years ago, we invaded Pakistan's airspace at Abbottabad with SEAL Team 6. Would you like to comment on that, sir?
Surely. I didn't say the president made a commitment that he would not, that we would not invade foreign airspace. What I was cautioning was the presumption that I think exists that these drone operations are taking place without the support, approval of foreign governments whose airspace those drones operate within. The president must maintain the ability to take action as appropriate. And as you know, he authorized what was initially a covert action program to take bin Laden down. And then he acknowledged that this was an action that was taken without consultation with the Pakistani government, much less its approval. So there are circumstances where I know that the commander-in-chief is going to continue to exercise his responsibility to do what is necessary. And sometimes that's going to be going into foreign airspace without the prior consent of the government.
We're reaching the witching hour. So what I'd like to do is take three questions right over here. These two, please.
Thank you. Tolgatanis with you, Riet. I have a follow-up question to Bruce, the standards issue, to be more specific. Given the concerns about the direction of Turkey in terms of the authoritarianism or rule of law or press freedom problems or civilian casualties in the struggle against the Kurds, do you think that the practices of Turkish governments, how do the practices of Turkish governments impact the cooperation between the two intelligence services? And how would you characterize the cooperation with your Turkish counterparts while there are several differences in Syria about which groups are radicals, which groups are not?
Let's bundle another question with that and just be the last one, please.
On the heels of Pentagon's decision to equip South Korea with the THAAD missile defense system, North Korea said that they're going to retaliate. China's upset. Russia's upset. Can you talk about that delicate balance of protecting an ally and upsetting near peers?
You can take one more.
Yeah, we'll take one more. This gentleman right here.
Alex Emmons with The Intercept. My question is, if the next president, whoever that might be, rescinds the recent executive order on targeted killings or withdraws the 2013 presidential policy directive, would the agency then abandon the near certainty standard or relax its targeting standards for drone strikes?
First question, as far as our Turkish partners, the Turks are very close partners of ours on a number of fronts, as we know that Turkey has been the ingress and egress point for so many members of ISIL, foreign fighters and others that have joined. I have very close interaction with my Turkish counterpart. And Turkey has a number of issues that it's having to deal with, given where it's located geographically. So it is a very strong supporter of the Free Syrian Army and the moderate opposition as far as trying to ensure that Bashar Assad is not part of Syria's future. At the same time, they have some very legitimate concerns about terrorism that has been perpetrated against Turkish citizens by the PKK, which is a terrorist organization. And as I think as you are alluding to, the Syrian Kurds in the northern part of Syria straddled that border and have been, in fact, a partner of, in some of the coalition efforts to try to uproot and destroy ISIL in that area. I must say, in my experience working on Middle Eastern issues, Syria is the most complex, complicated issue I've ever had to deal with, because there are so many internal players, so many external players, so many goals and objectives that are frequently in tension with one another. So do we agree with Turkey on everything that is happening in that area? No, we do not. We are very open and honest with the Turks when we have disagreements, when we think that they should be doing more. They certainly have expressed their disagreements with us and disapproval of some of the initiatives that we, the U.S. government, have embarked on. But this is what close partners and allies do, which is to have that open dialogue. But we do have regular interaction with the Turks. Now, there are some things that are going on inside the Turkish political system that are subject to a lot of debate and even controversy. But I'll just leave it that we do work close with the Turks. As far as the deployment of THAAD and South Korea, clearly, Kim Jong-un continues to go down a road that is exceptionally sort of irresponsible as far as regional and global security, with his further development of nuclear weapons as well as ballistic missiles. And he has demonstrated that he is not going to ratchet back on any of these sort of activities in terms of tests and other things. We have certain obligations to our partners in the region so that appropriate steps are taken to reassure our friends, partners, and allies of U.S. commitment to the security of that area. This is going to be a continuous process. I know that there are objections to some of the things that the United States may be moving forward with as far as trying to ensure that we have a strong defense. But this is something that is done in very close consultation with our partners in the region. I think the president has demonstrated that we're trying to deal with these issues in a manner that is not going to lead to any escalation of tensions. What we want to do is make sure that we're able to fulfill our obligations in that region. As far as the next president's concerned, the president, President Obama, put out the presidential policy guidance. It is something that the U.S. government as a whole adheres to in terms of near certainty of target identification, no collateral, whatever. It is a was put out as part of an executive action of the president, which any individual, any subsequent president can change. The CIA follows the guidance that comes from the commander-in-chief, the chief executive. Whether it be guidance like this or covert action finding, everything that the agency does on the covert action front requires the president's signature on a covert action finding. We don't just take off and do things that are in rogue. But if this president or the next president decides to change existing direction and policy guidance, it is the agency's responsibility to carry out that direction to the best of its ability. Now, picking up on what Bruce said before, if a president were to order the agency to carry out waterboarding or something else, it will be up to the director of CIA and others within CIA to decide whether or not that that direction and order is something that they can carry out in good conscience. And I can say that as long as I'm director of CIA, irrespective of what the president says, I'm not going to be the director of CIA that gives that order. They will have to find another director.
I think we're going to say that if we could have you here for several more hours, there's no lack of questions to keep you going.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks also to Brookings for the audio used in this week's podcast. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, and email.